When you're talking with someone who doesn't believe that God is real, that Jesus is the Christ, how can you go about convincing someone or offering them evidence to change their mind? What about when you're talking with someone who has belief in those things, but the belief is weak for one reason or another? How can you go about building that conviction further and deeper? The Gospel of John, I think, is a gospel that is specifically and uniquely suited for those kinds of conversations. Open your Bibles to John chapter 2, and what we're going to do is look at one of the examples from the life of Jesus that John selects to share with his readers. And as you're turning there, what you may or may not be familiar with about the Gospel of John is that near the end of the gospel, he sings that why he included the things in this gospel that he did. There were many things that Jesus did that could have been included, but were left out. Seven signs that John included with a specific purpose. The purpose was that these signs would convince us that Jesus really is the Son of God. And so by believing in him as the Son of God, we would have life. But I think that that's more than just an apologetic thing. John's not just trying to convince skeptics and doubters. He's also trying to help us when we are weak in our faith. One of the ways that John does that is he talks about belief in the book of John, in the Gospel of John, on a number of levels. There were people who believed in Jesus on an intellectual level, but they lacked the conviction to follow through and to obey him. So what John is interested in is getting us from the point of unbelief or superficial belief to the point of deep conviction. And we're going to look at an illustration of how he goes about doing that from John chapter verses together, and then we'll make some observations that relate to the life of Jesus. John chapter 2 verse 1. On the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Now there were 6 stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." So they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some out now and take it to the head waiter." So they took it to him. When the head waiter tasted the water which had become wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom and said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first, and when the people have drunk freely, then he serves the poorer wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This beginning of his signs, Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Just 3 key details that I want to draw your attention to in this account. The first is the last verse that we read. John tells us that this is the beginning of Jesus' signs that he did. It's the first miracle that Jesus performed, but it's interesting that John doesn't call it a miracle. He calls it a sign. Signs have additional meaning to them than just the kind of the standard use of the word miracle. I mean, we understand the meaning of a sign in our culture today. When you pull up to an 8-sided red-colored sign, you know that that means something. It means that you're supposed to stop there. Or a yield sign, or any of those traffic controls that we're familiar with. The point is, signs are intended to represent something deeper, to represent additional meaning than the image or the object itself. And so, John specifically selects these 7 miracles as signs that point to deeper truths than just the surface amazement and the action that Jesus performs. The point of this was what is also mentioned in verse 11, that through this turning of water into wine, something about that manifested the glory of Jesus, and we'll talk further about that. Another detail comes from the beginning of the story. Verse 3 tells us that when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. This is not incidental, especially in light of the fact that this was a wedding feast in first century Jewish culture. Weddings there were not anything like our weddings here in 21st century America. Weddings in first century Judaism were week-long affairs where you didn't have the ceremony and then everybody went home and the bride and groom went on their honeymoon. Everybody came over and spent the first week of your marriage with you. I don't know if you would enjoy that or not, but that's the way that they did that. It was essentially one big celebration. And wine was not something that they used for drunkenness. It was the common table drink of the day. I mean, they didn't have an assortment of beverages to choose from. Wine was the main thing that they drank. It was diluted in different portions, mainly water and some wine, and that was one of the purposes of the head waiter that's mentioned in the text. But the point is, if you're hosting people for a week and you run out of something to drink early on in the week, that's a problem. You can't just send people home. They would have come from a distance. This would have... And so there's going to be some meaning to that that we'll consider as well. And then finally, when Jesus tells the servants to fill the water pots, John identifies that there were six of these water pots that were for the purpose of purification. It was their feet and their hands before they ate a meal to try to keep themselves from being defiled. And these water pots were not for drinking. They were for cleansing dirt and filth and defilement off of their bodies before they ate. So Jesus takes those water pots. He has them filled up, six of them, 20 to 30 gallons each. And then he turns that into wine. What is the meaning behind this sign? What is the deeper picture that John is illustrating here? Well, I think first of all, it's important for us to see that the absence of wine biblically in a Jewish context meant that there was a picture of spiritual barrenness there. When you look at the prophets would talk repeatedly about whenever God would bless his people, when he would bring them out of darkness, he'd bring them out of captivity, they would describe that in terms of him providing things like wine. Isaiah 25 verse 6 gives us an illustration of this. Isaiah says, "The Lord of hosts will prepare a lavish banquet for all peoples on this mountain, a banquet of aged wine, choice pieces with marrow and refined aged wine." The prophets would talk about when God would pour out his blessings, the mountains would be dripping with sweet wine. And again, not a literal picture, but a figurative illustration of God pouring out spiritual blessings. And so to a Jew, when you saw an event where there was no wine, it wasn't just the sign behind that was that this represented spiritual barrenness. And as we're going to see on in the time that Jesus started doing his miracles, the nation of Israel, the Jewish nation, was spiritually barren. Later on in the chapter, when Jesus goes into the temple looking for signs of spiritual life, it's nothing but commerce and deadness. Now, another message that comes from this sign is when Jesus takes these water pots. Remember, they were used for purification. By law, these were the things that were supposed to be a part of preparing these people for to eat a meal without defiling themselves by the law of Moses. But when Jesus takes those things intended for purification and he turns them into vessels of blessing, the implication in that is that Jesus is doing away with this system of law, that part of his purpose in coming to the earth was to bring blessings not through ritual cleansing, not through the law of Moses, but ultimately through his work. And so by taking these water pots and turning them from their purpose of purifying and washing to vessels of blessing, Jesus is pointing to that reality. It shows that he is the source not just of blessings, but do you notice the details as the text plays out? Jesus fills these water pots, 20 to 30 gallons each, six of them. So 120 to 180 gallons of wine for a week would have been far more than was necessary. And so the picture is that Jesus gives blessings that are abundant. They're overflowing. They will never run out. But you also notice that when the headmaster came and tasted the wine, what did he say about it? He told the groom, you know, most people give the good stuff first and then leave the cheap stuff until later on, but you did the opposite. This is the better wine. Jesus gives blessings that are both abundant and better than the blessings that could be found through the ritual observation of the law of Moses. These are all messages that come through this particular sign. The way that Jesus does this and the details that John includes would have been very significant for those purposes. Now, let's talk for a few minutes about how this relates to the cross and to our memorial today. How do we go from Cana to Calvary? Well, one of the first points of connection, I think, is if we go a little bit further in the text. We won't read this, but if you continue after Jesus performs this miracle, the next thing John records him doing is going to Jerusalem for the Passover. And when he gets there, he finds in the temple, the place that was supposed to be a house of prayer, was being turned into a house of merchandise and a den of thieves. So what Jesus does is he turns over the tables and drives everybody out. And when the leaders ask him for a sign for why he had the authority to do that, he doesn't point back to Cana, but he tells them in John 2 verse 19, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Of course, they think it's ludicrous. They think he's talking about the physical temple, that he would build in 3 days what had taken decades to build. But the text goes on to say that in verse 21, Jesus was speaking of the temple of his body. And when he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered his statement. So one of the things that's illustrated here in the cleansing of the temple is how would Jesus bring those blessings? How would he do away with this system of ritual observance that left people who were spiritually barren? He would do it by laying down his life, by providing a new temple, a new dwelling place for God among people. And it would be himself, his body, and his blood on the cross. It's also important that Jesus, with abundant wine, it's not the only time that he does that with some sort of food or drink. We know, of course, that on a couple of occasions he multiplies bread and fish. But think about what that points to, the spiritual reality that points to for us. It's interesting that what Jesus multiplied in his life are emblems that are symbolic of the same things that we partake this morning. We partake of unleavened bread. Jesus multiplied bread. We partake of the fruit of the vine. Jesus multiplied the fruit of the vine. And so the picture in the cross is that Jesus provides abundantly for us. It even goes back to the wedding at Cana. Remember when that occurred? It was the third day. His first sign occurred on the same day as his greatest sign. So the takeaway for his people, for us sitting here as we prepare to take the bread and the cup, is that apart from Jesus, there is nothing but barrenness, spiritually speaking. But with Jesus, he provides everything that we need. There's never a time in our lives where his body on the cross will be insufficient. That with Jesus, there is abundance. There is better blessing. And that's one of the things that we're called to think about as we partake of this memorial and remember his body and his blood on the cross.